I am ready to start our next session in our series of Ecclesiastes. So this morning we'll be actually finishing up the first half of the book and transition next week into the second half. So if you remember last week, we talked about the way and the manner in which we should approach the house of God. You know, we're supposed to approach the house of God with reverence and with awe. And we talked about the beauty of simple and genuine worship, that God's not looking for something complex or for big vows or for wise words, but instead he just wants genuine and simple worship. So we watch our steps when we go to the house of God. And this week, we're going to be continuing in chapter 5 and doing chapter 6 as well. So there's actually, we have quite a big text to cover this morning from chapter 5, verse 8. All the way through the rest of chapter 5 and into chapter 6 through verse 8, or verse 9 as well. And the kind of the proposition, the theme, the idea, as you remember, Kohelet is kind of examining the hevel of various things. The frustrating vanity, the enigma, the mystery, the ungraspable nature of some of these things of life under the sun. And this week, he talks about kind of the hevel of a wandering appetite, or the inability of things and stuff to satisfy our desires. Particularly, he spends some time on money and wealth and abundance and those sorts of things. So I want to show you briefly the outline, because the outline for this morning is very significant, because from chapter 5, verse 8, all the way through chapter 6, verse 9, we have a chiasm. And so we're going to look just briefly at that, at least begin introducing it, and then we'll read through the text and take a closer look at it. So what we have here is Kohelet talking about, in the first section, people who lack satisfaction. People who lack satisfaction. And I've been trying to debate a little bit the best way to do this. So we'll actually go ahead and read through chapter 5, verses 8 through 12 as we look at that. And maybe we'll just fill in the outline as we go along. So chapter 5, verses 8 through 12 says, "If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money," there you have it, "will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep." So we have, especially in verses 10 through 12, this idea of someone who is not satisfied, not able to be satisfied with his stuff. And as a result, I think we have verses 8 through 10 as an illustration of how some of these people act. An illustration of those who are greedy, of those who are not willing to be satisfied with what they have, and instead they oppress the poor and they violate justice in order to continue increasing their things. So we have this example in 8 through 10. If you see in a province this theme, the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness. Now, that's not new to us. We've seen that before in Ecclesiastes. Solomon's discussed oppression before, and he says, don't be surprised when you see this. We've talked about it before, and we know that life under the sun necessarily involves injustice, oppression, wrong things happening all around. Don't be amazed at that when you observe kind of the crooked nature that man has. No, instead, Kohelet has a realistic view of human nature. And like Solomon, we would also remember back in chapter 3, verse 17, that God's the one that's going to judge the righteous and the wicked, for there's a time for every matter and for every work. But believing that man is basically good does not really help us out in our view of how the world works. Because when you believe that man is basically good and you look around at the oppression all around you, then you're disappointed and shocked and upset at the injustice, rather than saying, well, yeah, that's how life under the sun works. Not that we should be indifferent about it, but that we should expect it. So then we have kind of a few, two really unique phrases, finishing off verse 8 and then verse 9 as well. I have this idea, it says, don't be surprised at this, because the high official is watched by a higher one, and there are yet higher ones over them. So you have this idea of a hierarchy or accountability, perhaps. That would be the positive view of looking at this phrase. There's several ways we could look at it. Positively, there's accountability. You know, if you go to one justice of the peace, just know that there's someone higher than him and someone higher than him, so that ultimately they're going to pursue justice coming down the pipeline. He says, so take comfort in that. Or you might even take it to say that ultimately the highest one, you could say there are yet higher ones over them, so the highest ones of them all refer to the divine or God, that God ultimately is going to bring justice for the oppressed. And that, again, that kind of echoes what he said back in chapter 3, where he takes comfort that God's going to judge the righteous and the wicked. But ultimately, as nice as it is to think of it that way, to say, you know, we take comfort in the fact that there's always someone higher up that's going to take care of the oppressed. Under the sun, that's not what we see. And this theme of greed and this theme of things not satisfying is a very negative theme. So I think perhaps we should see it like this. Like, for every official, he's under orders from someone higher up and higher up from him. And what happens is when the poor are looking for justice, it just keeps getting passed up the line. And it ends up, the justice ends up getting lost in all the red tape and the bureaucracy. And people, as a result, all these people that are higher and higher and higher end up just ignoring the poor and profiting even perhaps from the oppression that they're experiencing. And if we continue with that in mind, it might help us bring light to verse 9 as well. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. So we have this idea continuing of the high official, and the king would be even the highest of them all. It's a very difficult phrase in Hebrew. In a wooden way, we would say, and profit of a land in all of it, a king to a field is served. It's like, what's going on here? What is he saying? How is the king? The king is kind of a unique thing for him to bring up here. What's he talking about? How is the king interacting with this land? And I think, again, if we have a little bit of a negative outlook, it will help us understand this verse. Like, the profit of the land is for everyone. As people reap and sow and they cultivate this land, everyone is supposed to profit from it. But look at the king, who is served by the field more than anyone else. This idea of commitment is probably not the best translation. This is the same word as serve or work. Like, if you till the field, or there are servants working in the field, that's kind of the idea. Even the phrase, like, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, is this idea. So the New King James probably translates this even better. He says, moreover, the profit of the land is for everyone, but the king is served from the field. And so you have this idea of hierarchy and the officials continuing and multiplying the oppression of the poor with their greed, continuing to gain and gain and gain rather than seek justice and righteousness for the afflicted. So, and that's the most difficult phrase of the whole thing. From here on, we're able to kind of pick up a little bit of speed, a little bit of motivation or momentum, and see kind of what Qohelet is doing in this full picture. So if we move on to verses 10 through 12, we have, I think, even more clearly this idea of a people who lack satisfaction, people who lack satisfaction and are not willing to be filled with the things that they have, but instead are always looking for more. So he who loves money, there's our theme, stuff, things, possessions, will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. And that is hevel. We've seen this a little bit before, but as we know, stuff by itself does not satisfy even the people who love it. We mentioned a few weeks ago, I think, just this a poll that was taken by people who said, what's your income? And then after that, the second question would be, how much do you need to be comfortable? And the answer was consistently 25. The second answer was 25% more than the first. We always want just a little bit more. And yet that ultimately, what Qohelet's saying is that that does not satisfy. Stuff doesn't satisfy. Instead, look at verse 11. When the goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? So instead, the more you have, the more weight of responsibility you have, the more people you have. You know, if you have a bigger property, you have to hire people to come and help you take care of it. If you have a bigger business, you need to hire more employees, and you end up paying all of these people with your stuff to take care of your stuff. Not only do you have to pay people to manage it, but you also end up having this weight of responsibility to take care of these people. You know, their livelihood depends on your livelihood. So even in the situation we're going through today, in these weeks with the quarantine, you have, you know, like small business owners and people, or even owners of big corporations, who are feeling the hit and the weight of the responsibility that they have to take care of the people that are under them. That wouldn't have happened if their goods hadn't increased, right? Not only do you have people paying people to manage your goods and you're responsible for taking care of them, but you also have this responsibility, or maybe not a responsibility, but you have people clamoring after you for your stuff because you have an abundance, right? You have people mooching off of you, or you have people asking that you would donate to charities because you have stuff to give that other people don't have. So he's simply saying this idea that all of us know is that the more you have, the more is taken from you. You see this even with our tax brackets, right? The more you have, the more is taken from you. And that's hevel, that's vanity, that's frustration, but that's nothing new to our society. That always has been, and it will continue to be. So more stuff gets you more people taking your stuff. What advantage then is more stuff if what you get to do is know you have more and then watch it walk away? Is it really better, is the question. Kind of contrast the person with a large property and stuff and the person with a small property. The man who has little has really little to worry about. The man who has much is always worried about what he has and preserving it and cultivating it, protecting it, both wanting to, you know, keep it safe and to keep it growing as well. So I guess the question that what Solomon poses is, do you really want to be tied down by stuff? And you see this idea, this realization, even in the secular world around us as well. You see some different movements towards like minimalism or like the tiny house nation. You know, you have people getting rid of all their stuff because they've realized, they've seen this truth that often stuff is just extra that weighs you down. And so they say, I'm going to cut all of that out. I'm going to live a simple life. I'm going to have less. And in so doing, I will be living more. So you kind of have that idea even mirrored at times in our secular society. And so he sort of ends with this conclusion or proverb here. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. They have this idea, There's this kind of a beautiful word picture. It's like, you know, the guy that doesn't have very much, the guy who's just day in, day out, he's doing his work. He's got his little property. He's living with his little family, and he's going to rest well at night, whether he has a lot to eat or he has very little to eat. Why? Because he's enjoyed a full day's labor and he's ready to rest. And contrast that with this person with abundance. Perhaps even he says the full stomach, you know, the feasting and the partying, or the just so much stuff that you end up staying up at night. You can't rest because of your bloated stomach. You're too full. You have too much, and you end up not resting. Obviously, these aren't laws. These aren't rules. He's not saying if you're rich, you're not going to be able to sleep. He's not saying necessarily that it's even worse to be rich than to be poor. He's not saying that one is even better than the other. He's just causing you to think about why you would pursue that for satisfaction, understanding that satisfaction may not and likely will not come from stuff. Okay, so you have people that will not be satisfied. Now, as we progress, we're going to see as we move forward, and again, we'll revisit this idea further down on A at the very end, people who lack satisfaction. But now we're going to look at the second one, which is people who lack enjoyment. People who lack enjoyment. So let's look at this idea, who are unable to enjoy what they have. Verse 13, there's a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. These riches, this abundance, was kept by his owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. And as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again. Naked as he came, he shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. So there's this idea of this rich person, this wealth. He has much, he's profited under the sun. He's amassed so much, but then he loses it all in a moment. He's unable to keep it. They are lost in a bad venture. Imagine perhaps somebody that has sent all their cargo out on a ship, and the ship gets lost at sea in a storm and it sinks. Or perhaps you send your things out with a caravan, and that caravan is attacked by raiders, and you lose your things. A business deal gone south, or a startup that didn't start up. You know, the idea is that you've poured all of your efforts and energy into this hoard, into amassing, and in a moment, before you were actually able to even drink it in, to enjoy it, to profit from it, it's lost. It's all gone. And now, because of that, he's the father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. His stuff abandoned him before he even got to pass it on or to enjoy it at all. And so he ends up dying with nothing. There's a silly little illustration of this. This past week, I was visiting over with my nieces, and Stormy was building a creation. In fact, she ironically was calling it her tiny house. And it was on wheels, and she had this intricate creation of Legos, and she was showing it to me, and she was proud of it, and she had spent most of the day working on it. And then that was the day before we had the earthquake here, Salt Lake, and so she had her Lego creation up on the shelf, and the earthquake started trembling, and her tiny house was moved off of the tiny shelf, and it fell onto the floor and smashed into a million pieces. Everything that she had amassed, everything she had spent all her time and energy working on, just in a moment, was gone. And the nice thing for her is that she's young and there's still Legos, and so she spent the next day rebuilding it again, right? But this idea is that someone who has spent their life building this stuff, And even in our culture and in their culture as well, you just have this idea that you start with nothing, right? When you're a youth, you don't have anything. But then as you go throughout life, as you build up even just your little private economy and you grow and you, you know, gradually get a home or you get a job and you put your stuff into savings for your retirement and you begin to build your things. But what if something ripped all of that out from under you so that you're left again looking like a young fool right before you die and you don't have anything with you? That exact scenario is what he's painting. And so he's saying, as you, you know, you kind of have Job, this idea of Job being pictured here. Even, you know, he came from his mother's womb naked and he'll go again naked and he won't be able to carry anything for all of this work. It's a grievous evil. Just as he came, he shall go. So what is the point? What's the point of all this work? And in fact, you see in verse 17 that it drives people to darkness and vexation and sickness and anger. One commentator even sort of told the story as an illustration of a professor that he had who was driven to drinking, and he was kind of, he was just a drunk, but the kids liked him, all the students enjoyed his teaching. And he's heard that one day that the reason he was driven to alcohol was because a few years before, as he was working as a professor, he had been writing a book. And he spent years of his life preparing this book and working on the manuscript and editing it time and time again. And he's finally ready to take it to the publisher, and he's got a deal worked out. And so he goes and takes it to the publisher. And on his way there, he stops to pick up some things from the store. And when he returns to his car, the manuscript is gone. And it was the only copy that he had. This was before, you know, technology had things backed up. And this was his only singular manuscript for the book that he had just spent years of his life working on. And it had disappeared. And that drove him to darkness. It drove him into just this downward spiral. And it took him years to recover. And you think of that, I mean, even in our lives, we even probably know people who have experienced great tragedy and great loss. And it drove them to exactly what verse 17 is picturing. All his days he eats in darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. So what are we learning here? Stuff cannot be trusted, right? We don't rely on it. We don't seek satisfaction in it. It is, one commentator said, as apt to disappear as it is to appear. Even if it is preserved, right? Even if we could keep it, it doesn't actually satisfy, because the man who has stuff always wants more stuff. So we have this idea that riches, that money, that stuff is an evil master and really doesn't have significant profit at all. So then how do we respond? And that's kind of the question that he poses in verse 16. You know, what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? And we've seen this question come up time and time again. And so how should we respond? Does it mean life is meaningless? Life is pointless? Just end it now. It doesn't matter. And nothing you do is going to carry significance. No, he doesn't say that at all. Though that would tend to agree with, here's a brief quote from Macbeth. He says, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. So that's one way we could look at this. And that's one way that a lot of people, when they understand that this is how life is going to be and this is the vain nature of humanity under the sun, that's how they tend to respond. They say, okay, it doesn't matter. I'm going to go live my life the way I want and get out of it what I can. But instead, we're going to have a different suggestion by Solomon. And this looks familiar to us. This is the second of, I believe, five what we call carpe diem passages, seize the day. And as we move on in our outline, we'll just point out here that he's moving to, okay, so this is, he's observing what is good, right? I've seen what is good and fitting. And here it is. I say eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. And so we see a few things here in this text. We're not going to spend, even though this is really leading to the punchline, especially verse 18, I think, is the punchline of this whole passage. We have discussed it before and we'll discuss it again. But this idea is, you know, that food and drink and work, all of these simple things, not wealth and amassing and having so much, even honor and high places and prestige, all of those things, he says, are ultimately not satisfying. Instead, look at these very simple things, these basic building blocks of humanity, of society. He says, eat, drink, find enjoyment. And ironically, all of these are eternal things too. These are eternal gifts that God's given to us. This is what we're intended to do. This is what we're intended to find pleasure and joy in doing. Because God has created us to glorify him by eating good food and by drinking and by finding enjoyment in our work. Even here in the hevelish life under the sun, do these simple things. And notice that all of them are from God. You see this theme four times mentioned here and a few times in the next slide as well. But God has what? God has given these things. God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them. This is the gift of God, right? God is the one who keeps him occupied. These are all things from the hand of the sovereign Father who's set the times and the seasons. And anything that you have to enjoy is directly from his hand. Even the simple joys of life, like food and drink and enjoying your work. So even though we live now in the shadow land, let these hevel-filled realities point you to the future of what we will enjoy for eternity. He says in verse 20, for he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. That is another treasured gift from God. We could look at this several ways, but I think part of what he's saying is that he doesn't remember the hevel of his life, the difficult things, the oppression. He says that won't be the emphasis. Why? Because if you look here instead, and you're satisfied by little things that are actually huge gifts from God, then the joy of those simple delights takes your attention off of the hevel of the days of your life. So that's leading right to the punch line of the text. And I actually think that verse 18 is the primary point of the text. Is he saying, enjoy life satisfied, or be willing to be filled with little, right? And so now we already have themes coming through, the satisfaction, that's going to come again at the end, and then enjoyment, an ability to enjoy. And what he says is, he's even saying the ability to enjoy these things, the perspective to enjoy these things, is a gift from God in and of itself. So beginning in chapter 6, we're going to have this, we'll continue one more thing on the outline here. So what is evil, right? So we have what is good here contrasted with what is evil as he begins stepping down the chiastic structure. So right in the middle is our main point, enjoy life as one who is satisfied with those simple gifts. Before, he said what is good, these good gifts of God, and now he's going to mention something that he sees as evil. there is an evil that he's seen. And it still has to do with God's gifts, right? Or what God does not give. So he says it's good if you're given these gifts. But now he says there's an evil I've seen under the sun and it lies heavy on mankind. There's a man who God gave everything he ever wanted. He gave him wealth, he gave him possessions, and he has honor, prestige, a high name, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires. Everything he ever wanted, God gave to him. And yet what? God does not give him the ability or the power to enjoy those things. Instead, a stranger enjoys them. That is vanity. It's a grievous evil. He says he's seen this time and time again, somebody who's filled to abundance with everything they ever wanted. And then just like you remember the man before, just like the man before back here, who lacked the ability to enjoy what he had, somebody else enjoys these gifts instead. And that's what he's going to begin talking about. He begins detailing out this idea in verses 3. And following, there's this man, right? And this man fathers 100 children, and he lives many years, so the days of his years are many. But his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. And he also has no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better off than he, for it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to one place. So we have this, now the idea repeated of people who lack enjoyment. This person who God has given everything but doesn't have the ability to enjoy it. He loses everything before he can pass it on. So you have this man who has much, right? This man who fathers 100 children, right? He has an abundance. In contrast to the man before who had fathered a single son and had nothing to pass on to him, right? But this man, he fathers 100 children and lives many years. So the days of his years are many, but his soul is not able to enjoy. More time is no replacement for satisfaction. More years does not fill you up. It has to be something different. Whether your life is long or short, what fills it must be something other than stuff if you're truly to be satisfied. And he gives this idea of the funeral, and in contrast, he says that even this strong, even a kind of offensive, shocking statement that a stillborn child is better off than this man who's just fathered 100 children and lived many years. Why is that? I mean, the funeral idea, he has no burial, probably refers but that he has no place to be buried. This man is wealthy and he's lived long, but he didn't prepare, right, for his hevel, and he's left dead with no honorable place to be buried. And instead, in contrast, you have this illustration of a stillborn child who Solomon says is better off. Why? The stillborn child comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Now, this sort of parallels the idea that Job mentions in chapter 3, verse 16 of Job. He says, he's kind of calling out in agony because of all the difficult things he's just gone through. And he actually says a similar thing to Solomon. He says, why could I not have been a stillborn child? Why didn't you take me out before all of this happened? Because if I'd known it was going to happen, if I'd known all my things were going to be ripped out from under me and my family was going to be taken from me and my health was going to be taken from me, I wouldn't have come into the world. That's too much hevel for one man to bear. But what happens is this stillborn child, he kind of uses a wordplay on vanity here. One of the unique times that he uses it differently in the book. It comes in vanity. It comes into the world in mystery, in frustration. I mean, this child's just been born, but it has no life. The pain of childbirth was just present, but there's no joy of the first cry. It immediately departs in darkness. It's gone, but its name is covered. It's almost, in one sense, in this dark way, like it almost never even happened. Like this great process happened, but the child was already gone before it even came. Never had the chance to know or experience, right? It's never seen anything or known anything, and yet it finds rest rather than he, the man mentioned before. That man had no rest even though he saw and experienced everything. And this little child gets to rest even though it never got to see or experience anything. So he's saying, look, his conclusion is, even if this man lived not just 1,000 years, but he lived twice that. What if he lived 2,000 years? But he enjoyed no good. Then he is dead, just like the stillborn child is dead. But the stillborn child never had to experience the pain of not being satisfied or of losing everything like this man did. Our final verses 7 through 9, kind of complete the chiasm. We say people who lack satisfaction. Once again, all the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. So what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? And what advantage, we could say, does the poor man have rather than the rich man? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. So what's our conclusion here this morning? He says, all the toil of man is just to be consumed, but his appetite isn't actually filled up. We have that same theme presented again. Then he says, what advantage? It's almost rhetorical questions. And you have to wonder, is he intending a positive or a negative reaction? What advantage has the wise man over the fool? Is there one? What advantage does the poor man who knows how to conduct himself before the living have over this rich man who doesn't? Is there one? Is there any profit? Is there any benefit to wisdom, or even perhaps to poverty and knowing how to live and conduct yourself? And I think he gives this proverb as an answer and actually saying yes. I think he's saying yes, that there is something better about being wise rather than foolish. And there is something better about knowing how to conduct yourself, even with little, than by not knowing how to live in a life filled with hevel and have much. And here's what he says. Better. So there is an advantage. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. Isn't it better to go through a life, even if it's filled with hevel, with your eyes open, able to understand and know that hevel will come? Isn't it better to, yes, wisdom's not going to take it away. Look, he says, there's still vanity. There's still striving after the wind. It's still a frustrating life. But isn't it better to go through it knowing that it will be, expecting it, rather than being shocked and surprised by it? This goes back even to the very beginning, where he says, don't be surprised at oppression. Why not? Well, if you have your eyes open, rather than your appetite, even the word is soul, your very soul just wandering and looking for something to be satisfied with, who's going to live his life better? The wise man. The poor man who knows how to conduct himself. Because why? You can curb your wandering appetite. You can say, that's not going to satisfy. Stop searching for it. Stop searching for more. No, learning satisfaction and gratitude don't undo hevel, and they don't undo oppression. They don't break the cycle of humanity, this generation after generation. No, they don't make you immortal. No, they don't give you the opportunity to be remembered forever. But you will have learned how to live well through those things. And that is better than the rest. So our prayer through this text should be, God, give me eyes to see life as it is. Give me eyes to see, yes, a life filled with hevel, but that you would help me to live as you've called me to live, eating, drinking, finding enjoyment in my toil, knowing that these are all gifts from you, satisfied with less, filled and enjoying your good gifts, rather than demanding more and letting my appetites wander.